On this episode of the iFilmmaker podcast, we have Evan Borsier, and we're discussing the differences between hybrid mirrorless cameras and full-blown cinema cameras. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the iFilmmaker podcast. My name is Ariel Martinez, and if you're new here, welcome to the show. I'm so glad you could join us. I'm excited for this episode we're discussing with Evan Borsier. Evan Borsier is a award-winning, amazing DP. I love looking at Evan's work. He just does such fantastic work. He primarily shoots on the Aria Mira, I believe. And we go into good conversation. Recently, we were texting back and forth, and we were sort of discussing the differences between regular mirrorless hybrid cameras and full-blown cinema cameras like Evan likes to shoot. I have an argument for both of them. And what sparked this conversation was that I sent Evan a message asking him, you know, are you concerned that these mirrorless cameras, more really specifically talking about the releases of the Sony a7S Mark III and Canon's R5, which has its issues, but regardless, and how elevated the picture quality is becoming on all those mirrorless cameras. And my question to Evan was, are you concerned that that's going to be the new norm, or it's basically catching up to these cinema cameras? Essentially, Evan said no. And then we get into a slightly long conversation through text. And I said, Evan, let's talk about this on the podcast. This would be a great conversation. And so here we are. Super glad I can have Evan on the show on this episode. And we just dive into all the good stuff about shooting with both cameras, the pros and cons, and so on. But before we get to that, just want to remind you guys that we are on Facebook groups. So if you're not already in that group, go and request to be on. I'd love to have you there and chat with you over there. I'm starting this new thing over on Patreon where I am taking coaching calls. So there's no added rate to that. So if you're just the typical $5 a month member, you have access to that. So it all just depends on my availability. So send me a message over on Patreon. If you need me to critique any of your work, if you have a question that you need answers to, I will be available via a call. So let me know if that's something that you would be interested in. I have links down below on the show notes for this episode over to our Patreon, and I want to see how that goes. But I'm very excited about this episode. I'm excited about the a7S III. So on this episode, you're also going to hear things that are slightly outdated just because this episode was recorded a couple of weeks ago. I mentioned in this episode that I was on the fence about getting the FX9. Obviously, if you're following me on social media, you already know that I've already made that move. But this is going to be a great conversation with Evan. Evan does fantastic work, and I definitely wanted to hear his opinion, which I do value a lot. So with all that out of the way, let's get into our conversation with Evan Borsier. Evan Borsier, awesome to finally have you on the podcast. We've been talking about this for a while, and here you are.
Yeah, glad to be here, man. Wish it was under more normal circumstances, but yeah, you dude. Sometimes always good when you have the free time to make it happen.
It was so awesome and random, actually, that I ran into you at the Reebok CrossFit Games last year. That was pretty cool to see you.
It's crazy that was over a year ago now too.
Oh, like my
I was just looking back at that actually, because that was like first week of August last year. So it is unusual. I don't know. It's just weird feeling. Like it doesn't feel like that was that long ago.
The funny thing is that this was the first year. It was actually very interesting because this is the first year, and I actually talk a lot about this on the podcast for that. I made a couple podcasts with that, but this is the first year that they allow basically anybody to go and shoot and be within the rails of like basically media. So there were like a couple hundred photographers, videographers out there. And then I see this one person out in this hot sun with the Easy Rig and a huge camera hanging off of it. And I'm like, that person looks familiar. I'm like, oh my goodness, it's Evan. Look at him.
Yeah, I was definitely, I feel like of everyone there, well, I mean, that's not totally true. There were a few other, you know, things going on. Rogue had some guys with like red cameras, yes, who were shooting these like vertical things with cine zooms, and they had ACs, and that was sick. But it was sort of like you said, they like fired the media department last year. So this year was a free for all. And it seemed like everyone and their mom realized they could get a media pass. And, you know, lots of mirrorless cameras, lots of DSLRs, lots of phones on gimbals, lots of just like YouTube channels and stuff. And then, you know, sort of me within a mirror on an easy rig was definitely the odd one out. But it was a cool experience. I got to work on the documentary with Heber and Marston, which was cool. And, you know, they had reds too, but they sort of were out in the middle of things a little more, which was cool. But yeah. It was a fun experience. And it was a funny experience for me because, you know, their documentary work was really what got me interested in like CrossFit on any level to begin with. And so I had sort of seen the documentaries, got into CrossFit, got sucked into a local CrossFit gym, had like spent time doing that. The year before, when I was still doing my podcast, during the games, Heber had done an interview, which I think was the last one I did. It was like right before I shut down the podcast, and we never even released it. And then the following year, sort of the opportunity came up where they were like, hey, we might need help. And so to get to go out there and be a part of it was just a really cool sort of full circle thing for me. It was weird. It was honestly like being in a movie, because it was like, you know, I knew them through YouTube and the internet, and I knew all the athletes at the games and stuff from the documentaries. And so then to just like be in the middle of all of it was really weird, because, you know, no one knows who I am. I have no significance to that circle at all. But it was just funny to sort of be in the middle of this thing that's like, oh, I feel like I know all of this and no one knows anything about me. And it just feels like I got dropped into the middle of this movie I've been watching for the last few years.
It's funny because you're referring to the CrossFit world, right? I felt the exact same way when I started shooting CrossFit. I would occasionally once or twice a year go and shoot Wadapalooza, go and do some sort of pre-hype videos for Loud and Live, and to promote Wadapalooza. And I would go and hang out with all these games athletes and whatnot. And that was it, you know. And then that was the first time I go into the CrossFit games. But yeah, I did an episode with Heber and Mars after they released their documentary on Netflix, The Fittest, and it was actually pretty cool. It would have been cool to shoot with them. They reached out, but I was already contracted for the games already. So that was a bummer. Honestly, that was a bummer. But it was cool to see them and hang out with them anyways. Out there, it's good to see you out there also. So if we can, I guess let's back up, give us a quick intro on how you got started with video. Just, I guess, brief to bring us up to where you are now.
Yeah. You know, I have been doing this since I was 18, basically. I just turned 27 a few days ago. And so at this point, you know, whatever that is, I guess almost 9 years of doing this. Thanks, man. 9 years of full-time freelance. I really fell into it, honestly. Is like, the long story short is I thought I was going to be like a graphic designer, realized I hated Illustrator, and sort of fell into camera stuff through like a church internship, really, I guess. And was interested in it, got a DSLR for Christmas, went out and started doing just like whatever I could get my hands on. And so did the whole typical like senior photos, engagement photos, wedding videos, nonprofit videos, and music videos, and just really trying to learn and get different experience and work my way up. Started going to industry events very quickly, where I was like less than a year in. You know, I went to Masters in Motion in Austin, Texas, and was meeting all these industry people, you know, and they're like, what do you do? And I'm like, I have a Canon T3i and I make videos. What do you do? And they're like, oh, I'm a director, I'm a producer, I'm a DP. And I was like, I don't know what any of that is. But, you know, so it was a very quick learning curve for me. And I had no prior experience. I had no connections to the industry. I was like, you know, totally, I feel like that generation of like, watched Philip Bloom's picture profile video on the T3i when I first got it, and like, was just out there trying to figure out how to do things. And the like film and video content space on YouTube and everything definitely wasn't what it is now. And so it was a little bit of a more barren wasteland, which is, I think, why I ended up going to more events and stuff and just trying to figure out what the heck I was doing. But slowly, you know, started out doing the whole one man band thing, started hiring some people to sort of help me where I was, you know, sort of running a production company, sort of just being a fancy one man band who sometimes worked with other people, slowly shifted away from photo and more dedicated into video. And then, you know, hit this point where like people started asking me to shoot stuff for them, where I think the stuff that I was sort of functionally director, DP, editing, looked good enough that that was the thing that people were like, hey, can you come shoot stuff for us? And so transitioned into predominantly DP work, you know, and that started with just some like documentary TV stuff for ESPN and local commercials and whatever, and just continued to get bigger and better. And, you know, I've gotten to work on some cool stuff at this point, which, you know, I never would have imagined, but it's a little bit of everything, you know. So I still end up working on documentaries, end up working on some commercial stuff, working on music videos, working on the documentary at the games, doing a little bit of direct to client stuff, you know, especially during COVID. That was sort of where like I was in the middle of a big travel stint. I was coming back from Puerto Rico. We did a week on a documentary there when we were at the airport when they canceled South by Southwest. And that was sort of like the big initial, you know, COVID freak out here. And then I was supposed to be going to Europe and Asia on a project with Hewlett Packard, and that all got shut down quick. And so my whole calendar cleared up real quick, where I went from like slammed for the next month to nothing going on. And that's when I sort of, you know, it was like another month or two of not doing anything, but then sort of went crawling to the local direct to client relationships and was like, hey, you guys got anything for me to do? So it's been a funny few months and a funny year, but, yeah, overall, I don't know. That's my attempt to make a long story relatively short.
Good job. That's pretty.
Thanks, man.
Pretty good long but short story, man. It's very, very interesting. I love the fact how you very early on, and I wish I would have taken this route too, started going to conference events to really polish your skills early on like that. The Masters in Motion and all that stuff. It's stuff mm-hmm. that I honestly have never done, but I've always been intrigued by it. It's just hasn't happened, but yeah. I mean, I don't know when that stuff like that's gonna happen again. I assume it's gonna all turn virtual, but yeah. Anyways, I was thinking, you and I were having a great conversation yep. online after I guess the release of the A7S3, and we were sort of back and forth into cinema cameras and mirrorless cameras and the pros and cons and all that stuff. And I thought we can yeah. sort of continue that here. Your position is that you're in favor of the cinema camera line, where that gets allows you to do your work. Do you want to go ahead and clarify, I guess, where you're at with that? And
yeah, so I mean, I think, you know, really, like, just to give a little more context sure. for the conversation, yeah. I had been posting about, you know, there's sort of this whole like R5, A7S III, Canon overheating hype, whatever. And yeah. it's just a, you know, awkward space to be in. And I think that's where I was sort of just talking through, like, I want a little camera, and I just sold my Blackmagic pocket camera. And I was like, I just don't love any of the options right now. Like, everything has some sort of crippling issue for me as an end user. And so that's where we started talking about it. And I think you said, you know, does it worry you that like small cameras are getting so good or something like that? And I don't know if there's a different way to phrase that, but that was sort of the vibe I got, was like, does it scare you at all? You know? And I was like, not really, okay. but clarify the question.
Maybe. No, there, you basically nailed it, because here's the thing. Like, my thinking is, man, I was on the verge of purchasing the FX9.
Yeah.
Right. To sort of get on that upgrade. But you know, my whole mindset for any company releasing cameras at this point is, well, of course they have to hold things back. They cannot mm-hmm. hurt their bigger lines, or they cannot justify some cameras having better features than other cameras that cost more money. Mm-hmm. And I think everyone has already been frustrated with the Sony FS7, the fact that you need to have an extension unit to even just get time code in there. You know,
yeah.
and the few times that I want to have the option to get the RAW out, I would also need that extension unit. Not only is it $2,000, but then there's the VLOC batteries that come with that as well. So right. I'm not running gun anymore at that point. Now I'm on full on easy rig, which is fine, but not for every single project.
Right.
And so anyways, when the FX9 came out, it was a little bit better. Now you could get time code directly in the body, but if I wanted the option to get the raw out, et cetera, you know, they were still holding off on that. It was still up to 4K 60, which is, you know, whatever. Better color science, at least better autofocus, I guess.
Bigger sensor.
Right. Bigger sensor, all that stuff. Better image quality overall. But then when they released the A7S III, that whole mindset of mine about companies not trying to overstep or kind of step on their own toes just went out the window, where I'm just now wondering, how are they offering, you know, all these recording options and even better external options than their higher end cinema line cameras at mm-hmm. such a small package and a much more affordable price? Now I'm fighting with myself back and forth. Why would I do this to myself, where I'll buy the FX9 and have limitations when I can have mm-hmm. everything in the A7S III? Yes, I lose some things like and that was one of the biggest things for me, is the built-in NDs, right? That's a huge thing for me.
Mm-hmm.
But that's something that I'm willing to sort of go over that obstacle in terms of having a pack of NDs in my bag, rather than, you know, figuring out how I may or may not want to get that time code out. I'm sorry, the raw out of the camera, or if I want to go switch over to 4K 120 if I ever need to. It's just right. things like that. And just the price difference. And that's when I started thinking in my head, how can I justify $11,000, you know, as opposed to $3,500,
right?
Know, give or take some accessories. But, and that's where I'm like, man, there's no way I don't know how that would even be a thing for me. So that's when, you know, my question to you was, you know, does that worry you that you're going to get a camera and you're not going to get, you know, you have much lower end cameras. I say lower end just for, you know, price point and all that stuff. But you have lower end cameras that are giving more recording options. And
right.
I think that's when you said that you prefer to have lower image quality or something.
Yeah. I mean, so I think what I would say is that, like, at this point, I have worked and, you know, to some degree, continue to work across a lot of levels of production. Like, I've sort of been exposed to everything from, like, DPing big commercial stuff where, you know, we had a whole camera department and Fisher Dollies and a 4-person G&E crew and, you know, all these agency people on set, down to I've done the, you know, having my T3i and mirrorless stuff and going out and just one man banding things. And so I say that just to preface that, like, I think context to what you're doing is super important in this conversation, because at the end of the day, sometimes people, I think, get really caught up in just their little world. And if they, like, only do agency commercial, that, you know, they'll just mm-hmm. be like, oh, mirrorless cameras are just irrelevant and stupid, no one should use them. And vice versa, you get other people who are like, why would you ever pay $10,000 mm-hmm. for a lens if I can get my G Master? You know, there's this, like, there's mm-hmm. these worlds that tend to clash. And yeah. I think that it's okay that they're just sort of different things. But, you know, for me, I think what it comes down to is, like, picking the right tool for the job. Like, someone was just telling me recently that they were like, oh, well, the R5 record limit thing isn't an issue if you record to an external recorder. And I was like, at that point, I'd just rather have a bigger camera. Like, there's no world where I want to strap a friggin' Shogun to the top of a mirrorless camera, because it defeats the point to me of having a mirrorless camera, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There are worlds where, like, I was working on a documentary earlier this year that was a pharmaceutical thing, and we had to do some, like, very, you know, unpermitted subway shooting and stuff. And we used my Pocket 6K for that, because it just looks like a tourist camera. And so it was the kind of thing that's like, you're not going to get yelled at. We weren't going to try and, like, bring an Amira onto a subway in New York, because you would definitely get yelled at. And so, like, I think there's places for each of those things. And I think yeah. that, like, the opportunity now, like, you look at what Heber and Marston are able to do with little Sony cameras and gimbals, and it looks incredible. It really does. Like, for being two people and, you know, not having sound guys and generally not lighting anything, like, it's really impressive the kind of content you're able to get out. You know, I think for me at the end of the day, like as a person who likes to make cool pictures, the new cameras are super compelling because whether it's stills or video, like you can do a lot with a little and it's crazy how good it's all gotten. Like coming from someone who like started with a sick stop of dynamic range T3i and like, you know, when we did drone stuff a few years ago, it was like the DJI stuff that you'd put a GoPro on and it didn't have a downlink and you couldn't control anything. And so like to have a Mavic now, like that was even shooting with I did a shoot last year with the Pocket 6K on a Ronin S with a Mavic 2. And I was like, this is like $5,000 of gear tops. And it's ridiculous what you can do with all this, you know? Yeah. And so I think that that's super compelling. I think the other side of that is that like for most of what I get paid to do,
right,
that stuff just isn't going to fly. You know, there's like, there's people who need to have monitors. So we need to have wireless transmitters. Like we just did a shoot with the FX9 and I was pulling my hair out because there's no power output on the dang FX9. And so it's like, you know, all our Vaxis wireless stuff, we had to take a gold mount battery, put it on a chair next to the FX9 while we did interviews and power a wireless transmitter off of it. And it's like these little things that's like, sure, you could do the thing where you have a Sony battery on your monitor and a Sony battery on your transmitter and a Sony battery in your camera. Or you could do the thing where you rig it out on rails and you know, make it big. And that's all viable options. But for the stuff that I get hired to do, they're just not going to ask us to do that. And so that's where like, then the question becomes, what's the best tool that's going to, you know, be the best ROI, which for me right now has been an Ursa Mini Pro, and I've been really happy with it. But I don't know. I don't want to keep rambling because I'm interested in talking about this more, but I think that's sort of just the like the sort of macro my thought on like, this is really valuable. I don't think it really affects most of the world of what I do for work, though, if that makes sense.
No, absolutely. And I think, I mean, after hearing that, I think it really all just comes down to our clientele. I don't think that we have the same clients most of the time. I don't think I've ever, maybe I would say a handful of times I've had clients that say, hey, kid, I have a, you know, a director monitor or whatnot. And I'm not giving them a whole stand with the TV on it. I'm giving them a monitor that's hooked up to my own camera, whether it's I'm running and gunning on an easy rig, I'm just attaching a small HD, an extra small HD, you know, onto the side of the camera so they can see it whenever they want to. And that's how there's no video village with me really. But then that's some of my jobs and other jobs like the job that I had today. It's very simple. Just show up, shoot a quick interview for this big pharmaceutical company, deliver the footage. That's it. Mm-hmm. They don't need raw. They don't need those 10 gigabyte per second footage, right? But then some clients do, and for me those are few and far between. I like the option of being modular. And so one of the things, and it's funny because I put out a video that tries to explain why I went from mirrorless to cinema and now I'm going back to mirrorless. And I kind of, this is how you know I'm not a YouTuber, I didn't go back to say how I fixed these issues that I was having with mirrorless. In the past, I was powering every individual thing separately. I didn't have PTAPs or anything like that. So the audio recorder that I had attached to the camera had its own batteries. The monitor had its own batteries. The shotgun that I was using, that I still have actually, the NTG 4 Plus, has its own built-in battery. So I have to make sure a lot of different things are charged. And that's like a recipe for disaster, not including the lavaliers that I use, they're battery powered, and the camera's battery. So those are like five separate types of batteries that I have to make sure that those are charged. That's a recipe for disaster. So here now, I like the hot shoe mount option that I can attach my XLR module if I need to. If I need to, I'll have two XLR inputs. And that's, I love that feature of the GH5. I know you mentioned you don't like, you're not a fan of Micro Four Thirds, which is understandable. I fully respect people that do not like Micro Four Thirds. I get it. I don't know how long it's been since I've used a full frame camera. So I fully expect to be spoiled when the A7S III comes in. But yeah, man, it's just one of those things where they kind of already fix the issues that I was having before with mirrorless cameras for me. And yes, I'm not going to have that built-in ND that I was hoping for, but you know, now that I see the limitations for me, again, for me, for my work, the things that I want to get out of a big cinema camera, you know, I don't want to have to take my easy rig to get a few B-roll shots on any particular shot, any particular shoot. So yes, it's good to have the bigger camera if you're going to end up rigging this thing up, but then you have the option to not rig it up as opposed to always having to take the big camera, the big batteries on every single shoot. So I guess that what I'm trying to say, it's good to have the option of having the smaller size when you need to. That might be the case for just having both types of cameras, but I think most of the time I'm going to end up picking up the A7S III because I would say maybe 10%, if that, of my shoots, my clients is specifically asking for the FS7, you know? That's where I'm at, really. And I think for anybody, it's really going to be the work that they're doing, the work that they're being paid to do. That's really where you're going to land. So, yeah.
Totally. And I was just going to say, I think that's where, coming back to sort of the original question, it's like, I mean, I think at a certain level, I agree and empathize with that, in that, like, that's part of what my whole original Instagram thing was about, is like, I feel like these are so close to being viable, like, B cameras, where I would love to be able to, like, I really enjoyed having the option to go out with a pocket camera and know that it would cut with the Amira or with the Ursa or anything, and that I could be confident about what I was getting out of it. And I think there are times that's super valuable, and a lot of the stuff that's coming out now, I mean, even some of the stuff, like, I saw they have an RF mount, RF to EF mount, that has a built-in ND filter. So, like, that sort of stuff gets interesting. I think, you know, if that's kind of work you're doing, like, I've always told people that, like, if you're doing direct-to-client work, for most direct-to-client stuff, I wouldn't buy, like, a Red camera or anything. Like, the client doesn't know any better. Yeah, they don't care. It's totally an industry thing. Yeah. So just, like, buy... That's why I have an Ursa Mini 2, right, or G2 right now, honestly, is because we had the Amira. I heard there was a new RE Super 35 sensor coming out, and I was like, I'm interested in jumping in on that. I don't want this thing to depreciate a bunch. I was going into slow season. So we sold the Amira and got an Ursa Mini just to sort of cover the gap of any jobs that happened until the next thing came out. And the great thing about the Ursa Mini is that, like, to the clients who don't care, they honestly don't know the difference between that and the Amira. Like, it looks like a camera when I show up, and they don't care. It looks just as good. And, you know, to other clients, I just did a job the other day that we shot on the Amira last year, and they were more than happy for us to shoot on the Ursa this year. And, you know, they had a flat gear rate either way. And so it was like, I just made a lot more money on gear this year than I did. But, you know, I don't think, if your clients don't care, but, like, so the other side of that is the Amira for me was like, we did really well on the Amira because it was a camera that I had, a Red Scarlet W before that, a C100 Mark II before that. And the, like, the Scarlet W I found was really hard to get rentals for. People, like, had their own C300s or FS7s or whatever, and they were like, this doesn't feel better enough for us to want to pay you to use it over what we have. So we're just going to either, like, ask for a super favor rate or want you to shoot with our thing. So the Red didn't last long. Sold that, got the Amira. And the Amira was the thing that, in my experience, production was like, oh, this is our chance to shoot on an RE camera, you know? And so they were like, we really want you to bring this. We know that you're comfortable with this. And so that camera was like the easiest thing to pay off. I think we had it paid off in like 3 months.
Wow.
And so that was the sort of thing where, like, I think the other side of that is, again, depending on the work you're doing and depending who you're working for, like, I would have been leaving a lot of money on the table if I didn't own a camera like that when I was getting called for those jobs, because it was basically an extra like $1,000 a day that I was able to pick up indefinitely just to bring a camera like that. And so I think, you know, there are a lot of people I know who have, like, bought Red cameras and they end up sort of just bringing them along with them, or, you know, they're renting them for like $100, $200 and it takes forever to pay them off. But there are also people who are able to get higher end cameras who pay them off really quickly, and they're really viable sort of investments. And so that's where I think, you know, picking the thing that your clients specifically are going to pay you for. And if your clients don't care, get the cheapest thing that looks good. If your clients sort of care, you know, get the thing that they're asking for, if that's an FS7 or an FX9. And if it's like commercial production, probably just buy an Arri camera, because that's all anyone wants to shoot on these days, you know? So it's sort of like total pick your poison and pick the season of where you're at. But I think it just really depends on what you're doing.
It really does. And most of the time, my clients are not dictating. Most of the time, they're not telling me. I'm the one that has to ask them, okay, what picture profile are you guys looking for? You have a specific codec, frame rates, all that stuff. And most of the time, they don't know.
Right.
I'm like, all right, guys, is this a commercial or whatnot? And I kind of sort of help walk them through that. Do you want a flat image? Do you want color in there? Do you plan to sort of color this stuff? All right, let me speak to your editor. Let me talk to who's going to be editing this stuff so we can sort of, I want to make sure my client doesn't have any issues when they get my footage. And so, you know what's funny? I have the FS5 still. I have the raw output. I have the Shogun Inferno. The image quality out of that externally, raw to ProRes, it's beautiful, way better than the FS7 internal. Mm-hmm. But I always end up using the FS7, either because it's easier to travel with, I don't know. It's just... They ask for it, or I guess in my psyche, it's a higher priced camera. Also, because for example, a job like this, like what I did today, it was a simple shoot and send a footage. They weren't going to know the difference. So yeah, I can do the extra time, charge the extra batteries, take the extra case that holds the Shogun to do that, but they're not going to know, you know, they're not going to judge that. So it's easier to get the FS7. That's what it was.
Right.
And that's what it is most of the time.
And I think that's part of the thing too. Like part of the reason for, to me, that like the Amira and the Blackmagic stuff play really well are like productions, in my experience, generally know how to not screw up coloring Arri and Blackmagic footage, because it looks sort of similar. They know what to do with ProRes. It's all simple. Like there's not a lot to talk about. You know, it's just sort of like people can deal with that for the most part. And again, at least the world that I work in. And I've always found that some of these other things, it's like, you know, when I had the Red, they were like worried about if they could deal with R3Ds. Or when you have Sony stuff, I've found that some people manage to like really screw up coloring S-Log somehow. And like some of these codecs people get worried about. And it's just like, these various things that can sneak up on you. And I think to what you're saying, it's like part of the reason that I like the Ursa right now is the same reason I like the Amira, is like, it's really easy for me to put batteries on it, drop CFast cards in it, shoot ProRes, you know, I can shoot off speed. I have built-in NDs. It does EF and PL, which is a really valuable option for me. Like it does anamorphic, it does spherical, it does everything I need it to. And maybe it doesn't do 240. Maybe it doesn't do, you know, raw. Well, it does, but I don't really use it that often. But like, that's just, it does all the core stuff I need it to well enough. That's like, I don't get asked to shoot high speed that often, honestly. Right. Like I rarely get asked to even shoot 60. Usually directors are asking me to do like 32 or 48. And so it's like some of these things that's like, oh, it does, you know, whatever, HD 240 or something. It's like, that's cool. I couldn't tell you the last job that I used that on, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the things where like, again, it's super cool to have. And like for vlogging and a lot of other stuff, I think it's fascinating that like these cameras are all getting so good, and all the test footage I've seen out of the A7S III is great. But even little stuff like, you know, again, with like the EFPL thing is like, I have an A7S III on pre-order. I still have an R5 on pre-order. I don't know what I'm going to do, but, it's like the A7S III is the simple answer to me, with the one complicating factor B. I don't really want to do like a Metabones adapter, and I don't want to get E-mount glass. And like, that's sort of you could go PL or EF mount with an A7S III with an adapter, but it just all turns into a thing. And sort of like that glass simplicity, mm-hmm. and, you know, being able to work across different jobs where like other people have lenses and stuff. Like I just don't tend to work in an E-mount world. And so that's a slight barrier to entry to me. That's like, sure. Do I want to deal with adapters? Do I want to whatever, you know, which comes in with the R5 too. But I haven't used Sony autofocus with EF mount lenses, and I assume it's not great, but maybe it's better than I think it is.
So I think it is on some of the videos. It's funny. I keep coming across A7S 3 videos all the time.
There's a million of them. Yeah, dude. Sony's winning YouTube right now. Yeah,
they really are. I've been seeing their Sigma glass, the Sigma Art glass, adapted with the MC11 adapter. And from what I see is that the autofocus works perfectly. I don't know if that's across every single one of their glasses. However, for the longest time since I bought the A6300, I made this decision. This was like 4 or 5 years ago. I made the decision. I'm going to get all my glass Canon just because it's the most versatile mount and I can always adapt it to anything. It helped out a lot when I picked up the GH5. But now I'm thinking I might just, and it only helped with the GH5. Everything else, all my cameras now are Sony, every single one of them. So now I'm thinking I'm going to have to pick up some Sony E-mount glass finally and really take advantage of the autofocus. So some things that I've been lacking, I didn't even know it. So I've been, there have been times where I've done interviews. I mean, I'm doing interviews, but the focus is all manual. So I set my focus. I have very nice shallow depth, but you know, sometimes, you know, your interviewee moves up and down a little bit and now they're out of focus a little, they readjust themselves. So I have to look at the camera, and if I have to pull focus again in the middle of the interview, I end up doing that. It's things like that, that I haven't really known that I've been missing. So, that's something that I'm going to embrace now, you know, so with picking up new glass for Sony E-mounts, I want to really take advantage of things like that, you know, that would make my life, again, as a one-man band, easier. So that's basically my pursuit and my thinking in this whole thing. How can I make my job easier, not trying to impress anyone at any time? And I think that already being in the cinema world, you know, maybe not as deep, I've done maybe a few jobs at where there was a video village and all that stuff. But yeah, most of the time, you know, I'm gearing myself up for the way that I'm being hired, for what's paying the bills, you know? And I got to put aside what I think looks nice, because if I get it for what I think looks nice, I'd probably have the G2 as well, just like the Ursa Mini or a Red by this point. But I'm not being called for those cameras. So yeah, it's one of those scenarios.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's where, like, honestly, I think too many people get caught up in the trap of like the thing they want over the thing they're getting hired for, and they end up getting screwed by it. And so I think being able to see that is honestly like smart and is going to be the better long-term play, but it's definitely, you know, it's different worlds. And that's where some of this little direct to client stuff that I've been doing, like small cameras and autofocus, have been playing great. Whereas like usually if I'm getting called to DP something and we're doing an interview, like the director is doing the interview and I'm just staring at a monitor the whole time anyway. So like tracking focus isn't something that I'm really thinking about, you know? So it's definitely, it is a different sort of world, and it's a different world that both are totally valuable. And I think, you know, I always say personally that anyone who can like get paid to do what we do on any level has like won the lottery, you know, because I think there are so many people who would love to be on this, in this industry in some form or another. And I feel like sometimes it gets a little like clicky. That's like the guys who do music videos, like look down on everyone else, and the wedding video guys look, you know, a certain way at other people. And then there's corporate guys, and there's, you know, people who do more like bigger crew commercial, and then there's like narrative people who are their whole own world, and like everyone sort of looks at each other weirdly, and it has their own little special needs for the clients they're serving and what they're getting paid to do. And it's like, whatever works, you know. If you can shoot music videos on your A7S3, or like I follow this kid who's just like, he's a crazy photographer and does courses and, you know, make six figures shooting mirrorless camera stuff, you know, like I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And I feel like sometimes there's a tendency for people to be like, oh, well, you know, someday you'll grow up and get a big camera. And I definitely don't feel like that's the case. You know, I think there's plenty of awesome work being done with all sorts of cameras, and it's whatever the tool for a given day is. And I guess, again, to come back to the original question, it doesn't scare me, because it just means all the work's getting better. Like everything is getting better. YouTube videos look better. You know, little documentaries look better. Like everyone's able to make really powerful stuff. And I think that's really cool. And it's only a good thing for the industry as a whole.
I love that. I definitely agree. There's going to be a lot more options out there for people. I think that gear should have never been like a sort of barrier threshold for entry in this industry. It should never be the case. But yeah, I love the fact that there's more options for me. Kind of like an open market, a free market to all this stuff is better. More options mean you have a bunch more opportunities to sort of improve yourself. But what do you think 16 bits raw looks like?
That's a great question. I don't know. I don't know that in the end of like when you're watching a finished thing.
Oh yeah.
It necessarily matters. You know, I feel like that's one of those things that's like, I feel like the colorist might care more than I do.
So here's the thing though. I've heard that before, and yes, you're right. However, if you get any great movie, you know, whatever, Gone Girl, great cinematography, great movie. If they exported that, let's say in 8-bit, whatever, if you're watching it in a very low bit depth, you're still going to be able to see the good cinematography of that movie. And that's obviously because the colorist had the option in post to sort of mess with that. Mm-hmm. But you can still see how good that was to a certain extent. I mean, that's what I'm thinking in terms of, yeah, that's true what you're saying, that in the end they're not going to know, but I guess it matters if you know what to do with it. You know?
Yeah, I think maybe what I would say is that I very rarely see work from myself or anyone else, but specifically for myself, where I'm like, man, the light's perfect. The moon's perfect. The setup's perfect. Everything's perfect. I just wish I had a few more bits and that would really make this awesome, you know? And I see a lot of stuff that's like, that would still look sort of bleh with more resolution and more bit depth, you know? So well, it's like, which isn't to be anti-progress. It's just to say 100%. Like, it's cool and I'm excited for it. It doesn't like make me jump up and down as much as like certain lights and other things do, because at the end of the day, I think that makes a bigger difference to what you're capturing than, you know, the codec does.
Now, remember my modular argument. I love the fact that I can use things as I need them. If I don't need the XLR inputs, I'm not going to add that module for that specific shoot, but it'll still be in my bag in case I need it. That's the same case, I think, for the 16-bit. Sometimes I want to do my own passion projects and, hey, let me work with 16-bit color. And I know that I can really push this image if I need to. Again, I don't know what 16-bit's going to look like out of the camera. That's the way that I see it. I do not see myself delivering clients 16-bit footage. But if I wanted to use it for my own passion projects, if I want to do a project myself, I'd probably just shoot it 16-bit to see what that looks like. You know, and if it's everything I'm hoping it is, you know, that is something that would definitely get me excited, because again, I'm sort of satisfying the part where, you know, I'm not getting the Ursa Mini G2 because I can't justify that price tag, but I still have some toy here to play with in terms of raw, which that's kind of the way that I see it. You know, I get excited for that part. So it's given me a good range of options to choose from. Like the other day, I did a job for PETA, right? I went and did a quick job for PETA. What they needed the most was footage on one specific event. I needed to show up for like 2 hours, be very selective with my shots because they needed the footage like 2 hours after I was done. And I needed to send it through Dropbox. So I had to lower the shooting bit rate so that I can upload it faster to Dropbox and send it to them. You know, and I had that option to do that. And so those are the things that really help. And the others, in the completely other spectrum, you know, if my client needs raw footage, assuming 16-bit raw is amazing, it could also take 12-bit. I can do that as well. So it's giving me a wide scale of options that, you know, if my client so chooses, they can have it, which I think it's very, very beneficial. And that's kind of how I see this. Again, you know, having the options to give my clients, but oftentimes that's not the case though. Oftentimes they don't know what they want.
Yeah. I mean, I think, like I said, I think options are great. And I think that like being able to do that, you know, anytime that you feel that it's justifiable or helpful is great. I think all these like resolution, I'm really interested to see the next few sensors. Like I'm interested in this new Blackmagic sensor that like doesn't debayer stuff. I think that in a lot of ways, that sort of tech and whatever Ari's next thing is a little more interesting to me than like the pure like bit depth and codec resolution type stuff. But I mean, it's all cool tools, and it just continues mm-hmm. to push everything along. You know, I think it's one of those things that, again, just from like I had one job ever asked to do raw, and that includes like I've done the biggest commercial campaign I did was like $250,000 budget, and we shot ProRes, you know. And so it's like if that level of work doesn't need raw, I think most of the stuff people are shooting on mirrorless cameras probably doesn't need raw. Not that it doesn't help, but it's just like, it's another one of those, like it's cool and it's a valuable tool, but it's not something that I'm like, oh, I'm going to go sell my Amir and buy an A7S III because it does raw. Cause I never did raw on that. Like I've been asked a million times to deliver HD because it's going to broadcast and they don't need anything more than HD for anything. And so people are like, you know, you're shooting HD ProRes on a RE camera in 2020 or 2019, most likely. And it's like, you know, that's what people are asking for still. And again, I love high resolution stuff. I think 4K is great. I don't really want to deliver HD if I don't have to, but I think sometimes, you know, it's there's a little bit of a tendency for like people on YouTube to really like get all hyped up and be like, oh, now I can finally deliver my cat films in 8K 16 bit. And it's like, I mean, that's cool. And it's good for you. But like, there's a lot of other things we could all be working on that would probably push us along further in our careers than getting too caught up in that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that for me, the 16 bit, and I barely ever mentioned this when I talk about the A7S III, which I have done in the last like two or three episodes. The 16-bit RAW is not something that I really usually mention because that's something mostly that it's for me. And I know that it's not going to be, you know, I'm barely going to use that on set, but it's going to be for my own passion projects, which I do sometimes.
And it is, I mean, I will say to sort of quickly go back on what I said, I think there are use cases for all that. Like even, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, R5 8K RAW is stupid. And it's like, on the one hand it is, like, I don't really ever see myself using that, but I can see a world where like, if you go back to like what the Rogue guys were doing at the games where they were shooting these like vertical GIFs for Instagram of just finish line moments, like that's a situation where I would use that. Honestly, I can see that being a viable thing. And it's a very specific use case, and it's not like I'm going to go shoot, you know, everything like that, but
assuming
it's not
that the
a
camera
bad
doesn't
option
overheat.
To have. Yeah. Well, did you see the thing about, the EOS HD article about that all being firmware and being fake?
No, I did not.
It's really interesting. They did a whole thing. I haven't followed up on it to see if they had any other details, but they were measuring the temperature of the camera, and keeping track of when the lockouts happened because of overheating, and they found that it wasn't actually correlated to the temperature of the camera in any way. And so their argument is that it's a fake
I have the
limitation.
Article here. It says EOS HD testing finds Canon EOS R5 overheating to be fake with artificial timers deployed to lock out video mode.
Which, dude, if that's true, Canon just can't win a PR battle.
So Canon did that?
Yeah, I think the purported argument is to what you're saying about like you don't want to totally cannibalize your other cameras. It sounds like it could be a thing where they're like, it can do 8K RAW. We don't want to totally destroy the like C700 or whatever.
Okay, I'm sorry, because it was almost conflicting with each other. But so what they're saying is, I thought they were saying that the YouTubers that were testing this was faking it, but
no, the camera actually really does lock you out, but it's not actually hot.
Oh, so the camera just doesn't let you. So if it's Canon that is not allowing their cameras to continue recording, because I have heard a lot of people say, listen, I'm touching this camera, it is not hot.
Right.
It's not hot. And right. That always made me always put a question mark. So, oh my goodness. That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, like, this is one of the little bullet points. If you go to EOSHD.com, you can find it. But like they said, temperature remained at a very steady 46 degrees Celsius. However, after 30 minutes, the video restricted status activated, and the internal camera temperature was still 46 degrees.
Whoa. So
if that's true, you know, and if I were to play devil's advocate, there's a world where you could say, but this is also, they're using the metadata of the in-camera temperature sensor. They're not like measuring it with a thermometer.
Okay.
They're reading the camera actually has like a temperature sensor in it.
The camera. Huh.
So you would think that that sensor is what the camera's using to tell how hot it is. At which point, if that number isn't changing, why is the camera locking it out? You know?
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's an interesting thing. I don't even know how we got on this, but
that is so interesting.
Yeah, it's. I think it's going to be a big bite in the butt when it's like, it would have been one thing to just say like, hey, we've limited it to 5 minutes of 8K raw, but if you pretended it's overheating, like no one's going to like that.
So that article was posted on August 11th. There's one here on August 10th that says Chinese user. This is the day before. Chinese user modifies Canon EOS R to improve heat management, but finds artificial firmware time limit.
So I don't know. I heard a rumor that there was going to be a overheating firmware update. I wonder if some of this really comes out to be true, if there's anything Canon can do to significantly change that, and or if they will, but it seems like a big mess.
They just can't get a break. No. They just got hacked.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, you didn't hear about that?
No.
Yeah, they just got hacked, and they're using they're somebody or some, I don't know, organization or person or, you know, hacked their system is holding their information hostage, and a lot of people that use Canon, I don't know what service they provide to back up your photos. A lot of wedding photographers use that or whatever. They lost their photos, and that sucks. I think Tony, I'm going to put a link to that on the show notes. Tony Northrup talked about that, if I'm not mistaken, which is concerning.
Yeah, that's crazy. Garmin just had that happen recently because all the Garmin stuff was down for like 5 days, and they got hacked supposedly by, I think Wasted Locker was the organization, which is like some Russian hacker group. But the rumor was that it was a $10 million ransom to get access to their stuff again. And then the follow-up rumor, I don't know if Garmin ever admitted it, but was that Garmin paid it. So,
oh my gosh.
Yeah, crazy. Everyone's getting hacked. It's another case of all these hackers have extra free time.
Yeah.
Get on the coronavirus, hack a big company train.
Yeah, man. Yeah, here it is. It's Tony and Chelsea's channel, Northrup, talking about the Canon hacked. It's just another problem for the EOS R5. Oh my gosh. Canon is just getting slaughtered right now.
Yeah. Well, I definitely feel like they lost the YouTube game compared to the A7S III.
Oh, of course, man. And the fact that they came out a week apart is on top of the world when the EOS R5 and 6 came out before people knew about the overheating. And I was a big advocate. A lot of people were talking about the rumors. And I said, guys, at least they're upfront with it. They're telling you the limitations. 8K RAW, 20 minutes, fine. At least I know that. 4K 120 for 20 minutes, fine. At least I know that. I don't shoot for that long anyways at 120. But then I started seeing people getting overheating in 4K 60, 4K 24.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, I can't defend Canon. That's something that's pretty basic at that point.
Right.
So I kind of jumped off that train.
Yeah.
But man, it seems like it's one of those things that just because you can do it, maybe you shouldn't. you know?
Yeah. Well, that's where I feel a little bit like, because I've also, that's the one other thing that's interesting to me is I've heard conflicting things about the A7S3 overheating. Cause I heard some stuff about, especially outdoors, that the A7S3 was tending to overheat. And I'm wondering if these are both sort of like rushed cameras at a certain level, you know, that's like Canon was like, we want to be first to the gun, just push it out and we're going to get it done. And then Sony was like, they're announcing it. We got to announce ours. We've waited too long. And it's like the next thing is going to be the time where they sort all this out. But it feels a little rushed to me.
Well, I don't, the Canon for sure is rushed. I do not think the Sony is rushed. And let me tell you why. First of all, we waited 5 years. You know, what's another few months or whatever. Second, I haven't heard as many things of that, like Sony overheating. And the things that I have heard is like maybe after, I mean, I don't know if you saw Philip Bloom's, I guess, movie review of the A7S3. He tried really hard to get that thing to overheat. He ended up running out of battery. So when you do hear it, people are actually trying to make it overheat. If you're shooting so that you can try to make it overheat, you know it's a good camera. Like if you're having a problem trying to do that. So I definitely give Sony the benefit of the doubt on this one. And yeah, man, I don't think that that's going to be an issue, at least for me at all. So
yeah, I hope not. You know, and I mean, I think that's the, that's part of the, like, the hope would be that everything, all these issues are more overblown than they initially seemed. But I mean, the other thing that's disappointing to me, honestly, is just how hard it seems to be to get an R5. I was on that pre-order list pretty early. And at this point, you know, it's been 2 weeks and nothing shipped. And Adorama said they're expecting their next batch the second week of September. And they
Is it still sold out?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Adorama, I think I pre-ordered at 10 a.m. and I think they went up at 9 a.m. And at this point, I missed the first batch. They can't even tell me with confidence that I'm in the second batch. but they said they're not getting any more of them until the middle of September, which seems crazy to me.
Middle of September?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
So I'm curious to see if the A7S3 deals with that too. Like, I'm sort of wondering, because I wasn't as early on that list, I don't think, even to wonder when those are actually going to get out into the world.
I think I put my pre-order in like 3 days after the announcement.
Okay. I think I was same day, but I was like later in the day. But that's where, like I said, I mean, it only took an hour late on the Canon announcement to be in the second batch, which was over a month later, apparently.
Oh, man. But yeah, I mean, I'm still surprised that, yeah, they're not in stock on B&H either. I'm surprised that people are still flocking over there.
I honestly wonder how many of them they're actually able to get out, just given the whole state of the world right now. Yeah. You know, like if there's just an issue, if there's bottleneck with making them and getting them into the country and stuff.
Yeah, that's true.
Because a lot of stuff's like that. Like the, wasn't it like Nintendo Switches were like totally shut down and they started being like $600 because Nintendo just couldn't get any more into the country?
Yeah, man, I was trying to pick one of those up. I went over a buddy of mine's house and it was me, my fiance, and him and his wife. We had so much fun playing Mario Kart. They're like, cool. Oh man, this is so much fun. I want to get one.
Yeah.
Just for that time where I just want a little bit of leisure.
Right. Well, especially in the, you know, sitting at home doing whatever. Like, I definitely had a few weeks of playing Call of Duty when all this started and then realized I had to go back to being productive. But the Switch was a hot commodity, but it was definitely hard to get your hands on.
Is it still hard to get your hands on it?
That's a good question. I should look right now.
I looked recently and it was still like at six, seven. It was expensive. People are raising the price on that thing.
Yeah, I mean, right now, it doesn't look like it's available online at the first few places I checked, so
yeah,
probably still marked up. Anyway, we're off subject.
Yeah, man. So all in all, I guess to wrap up this episode, just go with what works for you.
Totally. And I, you know, I think there are probably a lot of photographers who maybe do a little bit of video who the R5 is going to be the perfect tool for them too. Like it seems like a sick photo camera. So.
Yeah, 45 megapixels is a lot.
Yeah.
It's a great sick stills camera.
I will say too, though, the other thing that I, you know, was sort of teasing the other day on my Instagram was just like how expensive all these cameras have gotten. Like the little cameras are getting up into big camera prices, and there's a lot of other things in that, in those price points, whether it's the A7S III or the, you know, the R5. I mean, what's an A7S III body again at this point?
3,500, I think.
Yeah, and an Ursa Mini Pro G2, I mean, is 5,900. So, I mean, that's still more money, but you're not,
yeah,
you're not worlds apart at that point, you know.
It's a $2,500 difference.
Yeah, I think I made the observation that for the price of an R5, I could buy a Canon 60 Mark II, a Blackmagic Pocket 6K, and one of those little Sony VF1 or whatever vlog cameras that they're pushing right now. And it's just crazy, you know, not that you necessarily want three cameras, but they are. It's interesting just to think about, you know, and this comes back to my whole conundrum of like, what's the right tool for the job? Like, is it worth trying to get one thing, or, you know, do you go back a generation or two? I really wish Sony would have just gotten with the flip screen thing sooner, because I'd love to get like a one or two generation old Sony, but
yeah,
I don't really like their old screens. And so now I gotta pay $4,000 for a flip screen camera.
that's another thing that the GH5 spoiled me on, is that flip screen, man. I remember one time, and I took a picture of this, just because it was like one of those wow moments. I was getting a car interview, and just being able to just hold the camera with my hand at the corner. I was in the passenger seat, just hold it at the corner of the windshield right there, pointed at the driver, and I can just flip that screen and see that I'm not in the shot. And the driver's framed up perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
The IBIS was working beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
And that shot came out so good, so good. And it's just things like that. That was one of those moments where I'm like, wow, I miss mirrorless cameras like this. To be able to do that shot like that, I would never be able to do this with the FS7, you know, FS5, things like that. And, you know, obviously vice versa. There's other things that that camera cannot do that those cameras can. But that was just one of those moments where, man, this is so versatile. This is the stuff that I've done several car interviews many times, you know, so those are the things that I think about, you know, for my work.
No, and I mean, I think honestly, like the FX9 A7S III is going to be a freaking deadly combo. Like you can do so much with those two cameras.
I had somebody write to me say, man, just you already got the A7S III, just sell the FS7, the FS5, the A6300 and the A6600. That's four cameras, and just get the FX9. And those two, that's it, you're good. I'm like, that got me thinking.
Yeah.
I was like, oh my gosh, I mean, that's so true.
And then, you know, because that is a little bit of the game that I started thinking out too, where I was like, if I were to go with the A7S III, is there a world where I should sell my Ursa, you know, sell the Pocket, sell my Canon glass, just get an FX9 and just sort of go in on Sony, you know, for a little bit. And, you know, I think it's probably going to be a really good option for a lot of people. I was talking to a friend of mine who owns the FX9 the other day, and he was talking about, and I don't know how true this is, but he had heard that they're working on an expansion unit that will have built-in wireless audio and video transmission. Do you know anything about that? That was like, you can basically use it as a Teradek and run wireless mics into it, all as part of the like backpack unit. I was like, if that's true, that's sick.
That would be incredibly sick. I cannot see that being lower than $6,000.
Oh, no, I'm sure it would be expensive. But it would be such a perfect little like all-in-one dock package.
No, 100%. Maybe included in the package, in the invoice. But something like that for me, again, I think you and I work differently. I would get it mostly for convenience.
Mm-hmm.
And convenience to me, I cannot justify $6,000, you know?
Right.
And again, I'm not saying that would be the price. So the same thing with time code. If every single one of my jobs required time code, I would have easily bought the $2,000 extension unit, but that's not the case for me.
Right.
You know, so it's one of those things on a need basis. And I'm willing to spend money on convenience, but I guess I have to justify it somehow at some point. And, you know, only if it will guarantee me more work, then it's worth it.
Right.
But I think that I don't know. I haven't made a decision yet, but I haven't even shot on the FX9 yet, but that's something that is very attractive, actually, to get rid of four cameras and get that one, you know, the FX9, and not to mention the glass, because I have a bunch of Canon glass, 24-105, 70-200, and some sig, and they're both full frame. So I would have to get rid of the 18-35 Sigma that's so popular, mm-hmm. and the 50-100 because they're not full frame. I wouldn't be able to use them at all.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, that's sounds pretty good to me.
Yeah. I mean, it's a killer little package. It's a killer little, you know, two cam interviews, being able to throw the A7S III on a little gimbal, or being able to, you know, like you said, just handhold it in a car.
Yeah.
And having those relatively match. I'm curious to see if the A7S III is sort of like the same color, because I definitely noticed the FX9 feels a lot more like the Venice color wise than it feels like the FS7. And so I'm curious which way the A7S III skews.
No, that's they said they put the same color.
Right. But it's a different sensor, I think. It's not quite the same sensor.
Different sensor, but the same color science. So yeah, I haven't seen it myself, but when you see, I don't know how many videos you've seen or whose videos you've seen. Potato Jet, I think, does the best job of showing you the difference between previous Sony Alpha camera colors mm-hmm. and this one. Mm-hmm. And you can see those skin tones, that magenta is gone.
Yeah, it looks really good.
Magentas are very all gone. And it looks much more natural. And Maddie, I don't watch Maddie Hapoya too much, but I do like his imagery. He does really mm-hmm. nice shots, and he's of the opinion that, man, Sony is now, you know, with the A7S III, is a contender in the color science arena at this point, mm-hmm. you know. So those are two, I guess, encouraging comparisons and scenarios that I've seen. Now, how do they look together? I mean, I guess only time will tell. I'm sure someone's going to go out there and do some FX9, A7S III side-to-side comparisons. So,
yeah.
But yeah, I would love to see what that looks like. But yeah, that's very attractive. I mean, personally, I'm not a big fan of the FS7. Just after seeing what natural colors look like. And for me personally, I'm not a colorist. So mm-hmm. It's harder for me to get those colors matching and getting them more natural.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to be able to do it myself. It looks like I need something to get me there faster.
Yeah, so, no, that's fair.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of, you know, what spoiled me after having the Amira for a while is, like, I know a ton of people who love the FS7. I was never happy with what I was getting out of it, honestly. And maybe I just didn't have enough time and experience and didn't really shoot, you know, a few months in a row with it. It was always sort of one-offs here and there. But every time I was just like, I get that people like this, but it's just not quite what I want, you know? Yeah. And that's always a frustrating. That was sort of my same experience with the Panasonic stuff, was like, I've seen really good stuff out of this. I feel like I don't quite know how to make it sing, and it just feels like it's fighting me. And that's, you know, one of those things that, like, cameras like the Aries and the Blackmagic stuff and even the brief bit I've played with the FX9 felt more like that, where it's like, okay, this just sort of naturally does what I want. Like, it's going with me. It looks good. It makes sense. Whereas the FS7, I was always just like, I don't know if I'm exposing it right. I don't know if, like, it just always felt like this, like, mystery of, like, we'll see what comes out on the other side.
Today's job, I shot with the FS7 because this in this big, you know, shoot, they said, you know, we've been shooting this commercial. We've been shooting with the FS7. So mm-hmm. they asked me for the FS7. Not a problem. I took it. And, you know, again, I haven't shot with it in maybe 2-3 weeks.
Yeah.
But just looking at it again, I'm like, ugh, I don't know what it is. The more I see it, and not that it's horrible, it's just not for me, you know? Right. There's some people that like the cinematic look of it, and that's fine. It's just, yeah, it's not for me.
Totally, man. That makes at the end of the sense. Day, it's all pick the tool that works for you.
Yep. Dude, so I guess to wrap up this episode, this has been so much fun. Thanks so much for coming on. Where can people find your work and your social accounts and all that stuff?
For sure. So usually you can, if you sort of slap anything that resembles my name into Google, I'll come up. There aren't a lot of other Boursiers who are known on the internet, it seems, but my last name is Bourcier. You can find me on Instagram at eBoursier, which is my first initial and my last name. That's most of my social stuff. You know, I'm on Facebook. I used to be more on YouTube and podcasts. I'm debating playing with YouTube a little more now. We'll see. Maybe it's the Corona free time in me that's debating getting back into film content. but yeah, I mean, Instagram and my website is eBoursier.com. So if people want to check out the work, you know, my reel and some finished projects are up there and stuff. But mostly just some intermittent Instagram use and trying not to be on there too much. I find that if I'm scrolling for like a few days in a row, I have to uninstall it for like a week because I start to go crazy lately.
Yeah, same here. Awesome, man. Well, thanks for coming on. This was great.
Thanks for having me, man. Soon. Hey, awesome. Anytime, especially if you want to argue about tech stuff. It's a fun, it's always a fun chat.
That's always a good conversation. So there you have it. There's my fun conversation with Evan Boursier. I hope to have him back on the show soon, probably talking more into cinematography and whatnot. So just to give you guys another update, I've already went ahead and purchased the FX9. I should have it any day now, but follow me over on Instagram to see the latest updates on that. It's at Ariel Martinez Films. And don't forget to go and follow Evan. I'll be putting links to his website, to his social media down in the descriptions for this episode. And don't forget to follow us over on Facebook and on Patreon, where I'm now doing some coaching calls with my Patreons over there. So make sure to go over there, become a Patreon, and I definitely appreciate your help on that. Share this episode. That's the best compliment that you can give to me, is to really share this episode with people that you think that will benefit from this information. And I appreciate every single one of you for listening and supporting the podcast. You guys have been fantastic and reaching out to me for questions, and I'm able to communicate with you guys in that way. And just thank you once again for coming on and staying tuned and just being a part of this family. So with all that said, we will see you on the next episode of the iFilmmaker Podcast.